19. 2 days later there was the Reichstag fire. There have been few contemporary events that I missed so completely. While it was taking place, I was visiting a friend in the suburbs. He was also a referendar. We spoke of politics. Today he has a high position in the military administration. He is strictly apolitical, dutifully and conscientiously working on the technical aspects of attacks on foreign countries. Then he was a good companion, chagrined by his somewhat dry character, the product of an all too sheltered upbringing. As the only child of parents whose great hope he represented, he had been unable to escape the loving incarceration of their home. His great regret was that it seemed impossible for him ever to have a real love affair. He was certainly not a Nazi, but a nationalist, and for law and order. He could not find his way out of this dilemma. He'd always voted for the Deutsche Volkspartei, German People's Party, but he sensed that this was futile now. Perhaps he would not vote at all. His visiting friends were wrestling for his political soul. "You can't fail to see," said one, "that we now have a clear nationalist policy. How can you still dither? You have to decide one way or the other. So what if a few clauses go by the board?" A second friend countered that at least the Social Democrats had the merit of having integrated the working class into the state. The present government placed this hard-won achievement at risk. I provoked general mild disapproval with the frivolous comment that it seemed to me a matter of good taste to vote against the Nazis, independently of where one stood politically. "Well, then at least vote black, white, and red," meaning nationalist, the champion of the Nazis remarked carelessly. While we were arguing rather pointlessly and drinking Moselle wine, the Reichstag was burning. Poor Marinus van der Lubbe was found in the building, equipped with every conceivable piece of identification. Outside, against a flaming backdrop like a Wagnerian Wotan, Hitler uttered the memorable words, "If this is the work of the communists, which I do not doubt, may God have mercy on them." We had no inkling of all that. The radio was switched off. Around midnight we sleepily took the night buses to our various homes. At that very moment, the raiding parties were already on their way to get their victims out of bed in the first great wave of concentration camp arrests. Left-wing deputies and literary figures, unpopular doctors, officials and lawyers. It was only the next morning that I read about the fire, and not until midday that I read about the arrests. Around the same time, a decree of Hindenburg's was promulgated. It abolished freedom of speech and confidentiality of the mail and telephone for all private individuals, while giving the police unrestricted rights of search and access, confiscation and arrest. That afternoon, men with ladders went around, honest workmen covering campaign posters with plain white paper. All parties of the left had been prohibited from any further election publicity. Those newspapers that still appeared reported all this in a fawning, fervently patriotic, jubilant tone. We had been saved. What good luck! Germany was free! Next Saturday, all Germans would come together in a festival of national exultation, their hearts swelling with gratitude. Get the torches and flags out. Thus the press. The streets were exactly the same as always. The cinemas were open. The law courts sat and heard cases. No sign of a revolution. At home, people were a little confused, a little anxious, and tried to understand what was happening. That was difficult, very difficult, in such a short time. So the communists had burned down the Reichstag. Well, well. That could well be so. It was even to be expected. Funny, though, why they should choose the Reichstag, an empty building, where no one would profit from a fire. Well, perhaps it really had been intended as the signal for the uprising, which had been prevented by the decisive measures taken by the government. That was what the papers said, and it sounded plausible. Funny also that the Nazis got so worked up about the Reichstag. Up till then they had contemptuously called it a hot air factory. Now it was suddenly the Holy of Holies that had been burned down. Well, that suits their book. Don't you agree, my friend? That's politics, isn't it? Thank God we don't understand it. The main thing is the danger of a communist uprising has been averted, and we can sleep easy. Good night. More seriously, perhaps the most interesting thing about the Reichstag fire is that the claim that it was the work of the communists was so widely believed. Even the skeptics did not regard it as entirely incredible. That was the communists' own fault. They had become a strong party in recent years and had again and again trumpeted their readiness. Nobody believed they would allow themselves to be prohibited and slaughtered without putting up a fight. During the whole of February, we had been permanently at eyes left, waiting for the communist counter-strike. Not a social democrat counter-strike. Nobody expected anything from Severing and Grzinski any more after the events of July the 20th, 1932. Footnote, this is a reference to the illegal dismissal of the Prussian regional government of which they were representatives by the Chancellor of the time, Franz von Papen. On that day, protected by 80,000 heavily armed policemen and by the full support of the law, they had backed down in the face of the superior might of a single company of the army. A communist attack was what we expected. The communists were determined people with fierce expressions. They raised their fists in salute and had weapons. At least they used guns often enough in the everyday pub brawls. They boasted continually about the strength of their organization, and they had probably learned how to do these things in Russia. The Nazis had left no one in doubt that they wanted to destroy them. It was natural, indeed obvious, that the communists would retaliate. It was only surprising that there had been nothing of the kind so far. It took a long time for the Germans to realize that the communists had been sheep in wolves' clothing. The Nazi myth of the communist putsch that had been averted fell on fertile ground that had been prepared by the communists themselves. Who would have believed that there was nothing behind the facade of raised fists? There are still some people in Germany who fall for the communist scare, and that is the communists' own doing. The number who do so is not very large anymore. The poor showing of the German communists is becoming common knowledge. Even the Nazis tend to avoid this particular tune, except with distinguished foreign visitors. They still fall for anything. After all that, I do not see that one can blame the majority of Germans who, in 1933, believed that the Reichstag fire was the work of the communists. What one can blame them for, and what shows their terrible collective weakness of character clearly for the first time during the Nazi period, is that this settled the matter. With sheepish submissiveness, the German people accepted that, as a result of the fire, each one of them lost what little personal freedom and dignity was guaranteed by the Constitution, as though it followed as a necessary consequence. If the communists had burned down the Reichstag, it was perfectly in order that the government took decisive measures. Next morning I discussed these matters with a few other referendars. All of them were very interested in the question of who had committed the crime, and more than one of them hinted that they had doubts about the official version. But none of them saw anything out of the ordinary in the fact that, from now on, one's telephone would be tapped, one's letters opened, and one's desk might be broken into. "I consider it a personal insult," I said, "that I should be prevented from reading whichever newspaper I wish because, allegedly, a communist set light to the Reichstag. Don't you?" One of them cheerfully and harmlessly said, "No, why should I? Did you read Ford's and the Red Flag up to now?" On the evening of this eventful Tuesday, I made 3 telephone calls. The first was to my girlfriend, Charlie, to arrange a rendezvous. I was a little in love with her, but it was largely out of defiance. I did not want my affairs interfered with, especially not now. Besides, Charlie was Jewish. Then I phoned a jiu-jitsu club and asked about their terms and ordered a prospectus. I had the feeling that the time had come when I ought to learn jiu-jitsu. However, I soon realized that the time had passed when jiu-jitsu might have helped. A form of mental jiu-jitsu was what was needed now. Finally, I phoned my faithful friend Liesel, not for a rendezvous, just to apologize for not seeing her since the ball, and to ask how she had been, a more serious question than usual under the current circumstances. On the phone, Liesel's voice was tearful. She said, "You are involved with the law, aren't you? Did I know anything about what had happened to those detained yesterday?" Her voice failed her. Then, with a hard edge to it, she asked, were they at least still alive? She had not yet adjusted to the phones being tapped. Her partner had been arrested. This was not just a carnival boyfriend, but the man she loved. He was a well-known left-wing doctor. He was famous for organizing a magnificent social medical service in his borough, a working-class area. He had published articles in which he advocated legalizing abortion on social grounds, so he was on the Nazis' first list. I spoke to Liesl a few times during the next few weeks. There was no way of helping her, and it became ever harder to find anything comforting to say.